Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Good evening, all, and welcome to another Legends podcast. Tonight, we're going to talk about the great John Barnes, Liverpool's own John Barnes. I myself am a gigantic fan of John Barnes, but my two guests tonight have probably forgot more about John Barnes than I actually know, so that's why they're on. My first guest is my brother from another mother, and he's got some questionable taste in hip-hop. That's Joe Cousins. How you doing, brother?
How you doing, man? You're right.
I'm good, pal. I'm doing real well. And my other guest is my personal favorite football writer, and I don't mean that lightly. He is my favorite. It's one Carl Kopback. How you doing, pal?
I'm very well. Thanks very much. Thanks for inviting me on. Very kind.
Yeah, no problem, man. I wanted you. We've been trying to do this for a few weeks, and you got time. If you haven't already realized, I am an American here at my dumb ass accent. But these two gentlemen and the gentleman recording are all from England. So I appreciate that. So we're going to start with John Barnes moved from Jamaica to London when he was 12, joined Watford when he was 17 and around 1981. Now I've seen a lot of clips of John Barnes, but the problem is I was born in 1981. So I've never seen him live. And it's a big difference when you can talk to somebody who has seen him live. They can tell you everything you need to know, what kind of player he was. So, Carl, I'll start with you first. He clearly didn't start his career at Liverpool. He started at Watford.
Yeah.
What can you tell me about his Watford career?
He was, to be honest, he was inconsistent. He was obviously a talent. He was a very athletic winger. And he tended to play well against us in that early Watford, when Watford were coming good. He tended to play well against us, but I wouldn't have had him down as a natural Liverpool player at that point. Not when he's very raw between 81 and 84. He blew hot and cold, really. Obviously we're going to come to it, I imagine, but the big moment for him was his goal against Brazil, at the Maracanã. It was part of a Watford side, which is really strange because Watford were known as a long ball down the middle side. And yet they had really, really good wingers, and pretty good strikers as well. So it's a bit of a misnomer, really, that he didn't fit in that side because he was fast. His balance was fantastic. But when he first came, he just looked okay, but he looked okay in a sort of Jermaine Pennant sort of way. He might come on a bit, give him a few years, he might do slightly better. And I thought he actually went backwards for a bit, to be honest. So he was good, but he was good in a very sort of, and I've got to give credit to Graham Taylor for this as well, because, you know, he was his mentor, obviously, but,
yes.
He was very good in a very good side, but you knew that side weren't going to last forever. So he was that sort of player, really, sort of like, Big Fish, Small Pond, if it didn't really. No.
Okay. What about you, Cos? What do you remember him from Watford before he came to Liverpool?
Not much, to be honest. I didn't watch a lot of Watford back then. Watford were a good team, and the only sort of thing I remember from Watford then was the FA Cup final against Everton. Because I don't know if you'd know, but back then the league games weren't really televised, so you might see the odd live game, the odd live league game. You definitely wouldn't see week in week out football but league matches. The FA Cup was the big thing. All the FA Cup weekends were always televised live. So, you know, the latter stages of even Liverpool games in the '80s sort of stand out in my memory more than the league games. So my overriding memory of John Barnes back then was obviously the goal that Carl spoke about in the Maracanã for England against Brazil. The Everton Watford FA Cup final. And then other than that, just stats really, numbers rather than sort of memories from actual watching him at the time. And I mean, his numbers for Watford are really good when you look at it from a sort of winger's perspective. It's like around about 1 in 3. And what I've noticed just looking at his sort of his career at Watford is that he made his debut at 17. And you can see a consistency, maybe not in level of performance week in, week out, but number of games. So a lot of players these days will make their debut as a teenager. They'll be in and out of the side, you know, maybe play half the games in the season, but it looks as if he was sort of shoved in and relied upon every week to play on that left wing week in, week out. And the numbers look consistent in terms of appearances and number of goals. But obviously I didn't get to watch, you know, his actual performances in those games. So I can't really comment, on how he played or, you know, how I would have felt when Liverpool made the offer as to what sort of player we were getting. Bit of an unknown to me, really, because I only really started watching football properly week in, week out from the season he signed. Which was, you know, I'm sure we're going to talk about it, which was sort of breathtaking, really, from the beginning in a red shirt.
Yeah, let's talk about that first season, because he leaves Watford in 87 and he joins Liverpool for £900,000, which at the time, that's a hell of a lot of money. You know, this is 1987. Now you couldn't get a damn thing for any player, League One player, lower than that, Sunday League player for £900,000. And you brought up his first season. What was his first season like?
I did okay. Season was absolutely mesmerizing. If you talk about who we bought in the summer of 87, the money is actually, it's all about Peter Beardsley. John Barnes was the second signing, really, because we'd already got Aldridge in, because obviously the Rutgers was going, and we wanted Beardsley for about 2 years, and it was just, I've said this on many podcasts actually about him. Peter Beardsley was the most obvious Liverpool player we'd seen before he started, you know, before he came to us. There was a game we played them in, I think it was in like January 97, maybe 96, possibly. 86 or 87. Where at the end, it was a 1-1 draw and Beardsley scored. And at the end of the game, Beardsley ran over to the cop as a Newcastle player and applauded us on the cop. Which basically just said, like, sit tight, lads, I'll be with you soon. It was that much of a done deal. And that was 1.9 million, which was a record, at the time. 1.9 million for like a 25-year-old Peter Beardsley is pretty impressive. So when Barnes came in, he really wasn't the marquee signing at all. He was just someone they wanted to bring in. I imagine because Ronnie Whelan was slowing down a bit and all they're going to be moved to centre midfield, but they just wanted some pace, and Kenny wanted pace more than anything else. So when we started that season, for me, my first thought was always, this is all about Peter Beardsley, because he's number seven. He's just obviously going to be a number seven Liverpool player at some point, and you know he's going to be great. And then Barnes just went berserk for the first 3 or 4 months of that season. And then Beardsley started to play better as well, because Beardsley didn't start particularly well. And it was like watching somebody else, because he went backwards after that goal in 84. And so much so that when he was about to come to Liverpool, there was talk about him, you know, wanting to go to Arsenal and wanting to go to Tottenham and just going where the money was because they paid big wages and we didn't particularly. And there was, I remember there being something like, you know, Arsenal come and get me plea or something. And one of the, man, probably wasn't that rag to be honest, but, so when he got here, it was just sort of, it was like Benjamin Pennant. It was like, you know, we know he's good, but he's probably, Nigel Clough's a good example, actually. Remember what Nigel Clough, he got him slightly too late in his career. And I just thought that was what Barnes was going to be. I should explain, by the way, I was 19, 1987. So I was just about the right time to get him.
Yeah, and you've seen him live. I believe both of you have. Am I correct in saying that?
Yeah.
I have, yeah.
So this is two great people to have on here because, as you know, I could watch a player on TV, but you don't get that experience. You don't get to see how fast John Barnes was. You don't get to see the movement of John Barnes. You don't get to see any of that on TV because you can't pick it up. You can only pick it up live. So, cuz, why don't you speak about his first season? I mean, he really came onto the scene and he was fantastic. And like Carl was saying, maybe we weren't sure that was going to happen. Peter Beardsley being the big signing. And I believe they linked up with Aldridge and Houghton too, if I remember correctly.
Houghton came in October, I think. I might be wrong, but something like that. And Aldridge was there something before.
Yeah. I think you're right.
These were the days before transfer windows. So.
Yeah.
I think you had Aldridge sign in the middle of the previous season, maybe with a few months to go. And Houghton signed, I think, the October, November, after the season started. And the summer signings were Beardsley and Barnes, weren't they? It's interesting because a lot of times when we have discussions these days about, you know, the type of profile of players that Liverpool sign, I mean, a lot of times they will say that we're not really a club that signs marquee signings. But Beardsley was that marquee signing. It was a British record at the time. 25 years old, so peak years. England regular. I believe he was starting, in the 86 World Cup, wasn't he?
Striker
with Gary Lineker. Yeah. So it was a big deal at the time. John Barnes was like this secondary signing, you know. So I can see where there would be skepticism amongst the Liverpool fans as to, you know, what he could actually do. And it was just fireworks from the beginning. The first few games of that season are all away from home. I think there was a problem with Anfield, the problem with the stadium.
We were on the cop, so we couldn't, so we had to play our first three games away from home.
There you go.
He
was great in all three games. So by the time you can imagine the buzz around Anfield for the first home game, with the team, I think did the team win the first three games of the season? I think they did. Really well in those games. So by the time the home game comes around, everyone's just buzzing. And that first game, that first home game, is it the Oxford game? The first home game of the season, and he scores a great goal. That's just sort of the beginning of the dynasty for him, really, as a Liverpool player.
All right, and there's, you know, it's funny because we all hate Man United, and of course we're going to keep talking about John Barnes' Liverpool career. But one of the things I found really interesting in Alex Ferguson's autobiography. And hate him if you want him, but he is a great manager. So I can at least show respect to that. But he always expressed regret at not signing Barnes. How does that make you guys feel?
Tough. Sorry. He didn't. He got Gordon Strachan instead. I did something quite recently about the 4-0 game in 1990. And he said Barnes was the difference. And, you know, obviously he could pick a player. Ferguson, because, you know, he recognised, like, Solskjaer as a third division Norwegian striker, and, you know, and won European Cups with him and stuff, so, you know, he could spot a player, but it was different then, because United, they basically made big money signings for pretty average players, Clayton Blackmore, people like that, you know, who aren't really, you know, Gordon Strachan, Jesper Olsen, people who were big names, but they weren't going to win anything. Whereas we have people like Ian Rush, who's obviously just going to win things all the time, and Alan Hansen and, Steve Nicol, and then people like that. So, there's a little bit of arrogance from Ferguson. You know, I wish I had, you know, we should have signed him, but because I think, to be honest, I think if Barnes could have gone to Arsenal or Tottenham quite easily, but then I think that it was the Dalglish factor more than anything else, because he won. For a start, he's Kenny Dalglish. Secondly, he's already proved himself as a manager because he's won a double in this first year. And Alex Ferguson hadn't won a thing. Didn't win a thing. He started in November 86. Sorry, my memory's ridiculous. I think it's not that bad. And they didn't win anything for 7 years. So Ferguson's saying, like, you know, we should have signed him. Signed him for what? It's like John Barnes today signing for, I'm trying to give an example, Southampton. You know, they were sort of like a top six side.
Yeah.
And we were champions of England. Actually, we went in 87, but you know, but we were always like first or second in the league.
What about you guys? How do you feel about that?
Well, we were the most prestigious club, isn't it, at the time. So, I don't know how attractive the Manchester United offer would have been if they actually
put money.
A serious offer for him. It would have just been money, wouldn't it?
They paid way more.
Yeah, you wouldn't have the big London club sort of attraction, if you wanted to sort of stay down south. And you wouldn't have had the recent success that we had at the time. So, yeah, I can't really see it. But, you know, Ferguson, he'll have those regrets. I mean, he's mentioned not signing the likes of Alan Shearer. He never had a chance to sign in Shearer, but it's one of his regrets that he wasn't able to
get him Gascoigne.
Yeah, and there's a few. But it just made me laugh. I read something earlier in the week that they decided to renew Jasper Olsen's contract rather than putting an offer for John Barnes. I found that really funny. Yeah. And funnily enough, they actually had Beardsley briefly, didn't they?
Which I remember thinking at the time, Beardsley's not going to go back to United. He just won't do that. And obviously Newcastle had Kevin Keegan, Terry McDermott. So obviously he's got low Liverpool. He's heard stories of the club and the way we train and how we get the best out of players. So we did it in those days. So obviously, I think it's a pretty obvious link when Kevin Keegan, the great Liverpool number seven, says to him, Liverpool are going to need another great number seven because Dalglish is coming to the end of his career. Then I think, there may be some low level tapping up going on there. Because Keegan was his Peter Beardsley's mentor.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So Barnes' first season, basically Liverpool coast to the title for flying, undefeated. I believe it was it 30, 29?
29.
29 games. Yeah, it's an incredible achievement. Barnes wins PFA Player of the Year. I think he might have been the first black man to do that. If you guys can correct me, maybe.
I think so.
I think he won football. Did he win football writers as well?
I believe he won both. Yeah. Yes, he did win both. So he can't go anywhere but down, but he really didn't, did he?
No. Alan Hansen always says about that season, it's the simplest season you ever play because it's all I've got to do is give the ball to Barnes. When McMahon and Whelan won the ball in midfield, give the ball to Barnes and he'll just do something. And, he was just streets ahead of anyone else on the pitch. The closest comparison I can come up with in a contemporary, setting is, the Liverpool Norwich game where Luis Suarez got 4 goals at Anfield. And he's so far ahead of every single, including his own players. He's so far ahead of everyone that he's just, when Suarez is knocking in 45 yard volleys and stuff like that. And as I always say to Sash, that one of my favorite celebrations of Suarez is when he covers his face and laughs and shakes his head as if to say, I don't know how I've done that. I've no idea what I'm doing, but that's brilliant what I've just done. And if you can just imagine that game, which is probably the most exciting game I've seen individual in Anfield in a long time. If you can imagine that for 10 months, that was what John Barnes was like. He never had a day off. He was just on it all the time. And the only time he was quiet was when he was getting kicked to pieces to get 2 or 3 men on him. And then you leave him keep a beer to it as much room as he wants. And he's the last person you want to give space to.
Yeah. No,
and that's how dominant we were that season. And we should have won the cup. And it was one of those games against Wimbledon where if we'd still be playing now, it'd still be a goal down. Just nothing went right for us on the day.
It's a bit weird. That's how football does that. I watch a lot of sports, but you really see that a lot in football where people in multiple leagues, any team could beat any team at any time, no matter who's on the pitch. It's that Wimbledon team had no business beating us that year, and they won 1-0. And
well, say about, you know, they weren't as lowly as people make out. Wimbledon was seventh in the league, which again is like Southampton, and Southampton can beat Liverpool, what they've done. So it wasn't quite as low as that. It just wasn't working. I don't know if it was a tiredness thing. I was at that game. I remember a man passing out in front of me. It was that hot. And even when we got the penalty, everyone turned up and they just said, we just knew it was just one of those. It just wasn't going to happen that day.
So basically for you, every time Barnes would have the ball at his feet, it was almost like a get out of your seat moment because something's going to happen.
Yeah. It's like Sadio Mane now. In terms of pace, but Barnes also had balance, and he always says that was more than his pace or his strength or anything like that. He said his balance just got him out of trouble all the time, and that's why he could go past people constantly. Okay.
So we all know, and there's a big elephant in the room with Barnes, and I on this show I don't like to not talk about anything, and we all know what happened with the racism, having bananas thrown at him, having racial slurs said to him. I do give Philip Carter a lot of credit in that Everton game for basically shouting down his own supporters, calling them scum. Because you're a black man who lives in England. You kind of have almost the same stories as John Barnes, coming from where you came from, and I'll let you tell your story. But I don't want to say how does that make you feel, but if you put your shoes in, yourself in John Barnes' shoes, how would that make you feel? How do you deal with that, with all those fans?
It's tough to describe. I mean, Barnes is more, his background is a bit different to mine. So for example, my parents came over here from Jamaica in the 60s. John Barnes' his family moved over here in the 70s. I think the main difference is that Barnes' father was quite a high-ranking officer in the army. So it's quite like a sort of a higher middle class sort of background. He came over here in the 70s, as I said, went to a grammar school, rugby playing school. not a posh boy, but the different sort of in environment to mine, whereas mine was more of a sort of second generation Jamaican, grew up in a council estate and surrounded by a sort of predominantly black area. So I didn't really have the experience of racism growing up, just primarily because my immediate area were mostly other black people. But John Barnes' his situation was slightly different, where I would imagine he was probably maybe one of the few sort of black people in his school. Probably, you know, one of the few sort of blacks playing for his youth in the youth team league. So it sounds horrible to say, but it's probably used to the abuse through the youth ranks, from other players. I can't explain what it would be like for, you know, to have like thousands of people making monkey chants and throwing bananas at you. The Everton game in the cup that season, if you go back and watch the highlights, you can actually hear when we score the winning goal. I think it's a Barnes cross and Houghton heads it in. You can hear the monkey chants when he gets the ball in the left wing, and for you to hear it so clearly. It's not just one or two individuals that are doing it. It's thousands, hundreds and thousands of people that are doing it, and it makes you feel sick. By that time, John Barnes is my absolute hero, it's really upsetting. I mean, I think the most upset I've got is when he's played for England, and you get the press as well who sort of turned on him because he's not putting the performances they expect. So you've got the fans giving him stick and you've got the media giving him stick as well. And there is a bit of a racial element to the media criticism. I mean, I remember reading stories about, you know, him being Jamaican, so not really putting in the effort for England as he would have done if he was born over here. Sort of rubbish like that. And I remember a game against Holland where he got booed every time he touched the ball, and then he scored a free kick, and all of a sudden everyone was cheering. And to be honest, I've had a sort of mild hatred for the England national team just because of the treatment that they gave John Barnes in his early days. And even now, when I watch England play, I tend to want them to lose, and it sort of stems from that. For Liverpool, the Liverpool fans sort of talked to John Barnes almost straight away and had love for him. So from that respect, they've sort of tended to protect him. I've been to a lot of away games, from sort of the early 90s, and never really from a Liverpool supporter's perspective have felt any sort of racism or anything like that. But I can imagine from the opposition, just from watching on the TV, that it was rife back then, you know. And the way he handled it is different than the way I would have handled it. I think I probably would have been a bit more angry at it and probably react more. But Barnes is more of a sort of very much a calm sort of person. Even the way he talks about racism now, he talks about it from a different perspective than most other people do. More along the lines of you need to educate people and what have you, rather than having a militancy about him. He just took it in his stride. It didn't let it bother him one bit. Still put in great performances week after week after week. As Carl mentioned earlier, was really consistent. So in away matches where sometimes wingers go missing, he'd be getting abuse. He'd be playing on the wing, so close to the stands, and getting abuse, and it just didn't matter. He was still head and shoulders above everyone else on the pitch. So, a lot of pride.
He just smiled. That's the way the sound of it. He just smiled at them.
Yeah.
He just smiled every time a son came up and said, "You're not bothering me, lad. Doing what you want doesn't bother me at all." And that's the way he is today, isn't it, really? He talks about very, very serious subjects, but with a smile and a sort of, you know, I'm better than this. I'm not going to let you drag me down.
I think because the reason why I mentioned the middle class upbringing, Joe, is that I think he generally just didn't have an inferiority complex. So at no stage did he feel, sort of inferior to anyone. He was so confident. You can see the way he played football. He was so confident within himself, in his own skin, that he wasn't going to let anyone bother him at all.
Yes, yeah, it's funny. I'm going to read a quote from one Peter Beardsley, who said at the end of the 80s that the best player I ever played with, bar none, the 3 or 4 years at the end of the 80s, John Barnes was possibly the best player in the world. Would you guys agree with that?
I would. I mean, at the time, I didn't watch a lot of, I didn't watch a lot of international football at the time. So I would, in terms of best players in the world, I could talk about Maradona in 1986 as probably the best in the world at that period. But in terms of league football, I was only really watching English football. And for me, he was head and shoulders above everyone else in that period. So for between, I'd say, 1987 and 1990, he was the best player. Certainly in the English game by far, like by miles. In terms of Europe, not sure, because I didn't watch a lot of, say, AC Milan, for example. You had Ruud Gullit, Van Basten, and Maradona, as I said, playing for Napoli.
We were
banned, exactly. So we weren't playing in European competitions. So I know I wouldn't argue with Beardsley, though. I would not.
How about you, Carl?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the league, there's literally no one to touch him. The only person who got close to him was the man he played next to him, which was nice. You know, that's a hell of a side if you can do that. It probably was the best player in Europe. I can't think of anyone who can really come close to him. I really like Frank Rijkaard, but it's a different position. So, or, you know, anyone who's in that Milan side, 1990-ish. And it's my biggest regret that we never got to play them when we were at our best and they were at their best, because that would have been interesting. Yeah. But I can't think of anyone else because of John Barnes. Definitely not. I mean, he was just street ahead of everybody else. And every single week he was great.
And that's what makes a great player great, consistency.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's already been brought up a few times, so we might as well talk about it as the his career at England. Now, in my opinion, I think John Barnes' Brazil goal is maybe England's greatest goal ever. Now, I don't follow England, clearly. I don't really care about them. But maybe some of you fellas do, because yeah, I heard your take on it. But his time with the national team, good, great, bad, indifferent? What do you think, Carl?
It's okay. It's okay.
Yeah, no, very straightforward answer. I'm okay with
it. Well, I live in London, and when I moved to London in late 1988, and I was talking to people down here who obviously England fans, and I was, and I'm not really that into it. And people would say, you know, I was talking about John Barnes being the best player in the country and what have you. And they used to say to me, yeah, but he can't do it for England, can he? Which my answer was always, he's just won the league for Liverpool. That's all I'm interested in. And it doesn't go anything beyond that. He was playing, late 80s, so he would have been under Robson. It just didn't suit his style. It just wasn't really what he had freedom at Liverpool, which he never really got at England. And so I just wasn't bothered. I mean, there's a famous incident that, in 1994 when he's getting abused by the Wembley crowd and Graham Taylor, like, turns and says, you know, you're talking about a human being there. And, you know, Bardi was getting just tons of stick with everyone. And I remember just watching that and just thinking, he doesn't care. And I don't care if he doesn't score for England ever again. I'd rather he scored a goal against Notts County in a 4-0 win than scored a winning goal against Germany for England. Then my priority was always Liverpool, and that hasn't changed either. I don't really care, to be honest. I went to Euro 96, and I went to England games at Euro 96. And, I've gone from actively disliking England to being completely ambivalent about them now and just watching them like Sweden, you know, it's the same thing for me. I've got no feeling towards it whatsoever. And as long as Barnes was doing it for Liverpool, that's all I was interested in.
Okay. Kazi?
Yeah, my feelings are really similar, you know, ambivalent towards England. I mean, I would have liked him to have played well for England just, you know, for his own sake. But, you know, England results didn't bother me really. And I knew he was playing great for Liverpool week in, week out. So I wasn't overly bothered. But the criticism used to annoy me. So criticism from non-Liverpool fans, criticism in the newspapers, as I mentioned earlier. You know, speculation as to why he doesn't perform for England, all that sort of stuff. He used to annoy me. In that respect, I would have liked him to, you know, to play as well for England as for Liverpool, just to sort of put people in their place, from that sort of, respect. But, and as Carl mentioned, I mean, the style of play England had at the time, I never really saw them as a good side, not really a good passing team like we were. Clever players, not really. More of a direct style, whereas we, you know, Liverpool played with under Kenny Dalglish, a really sort of attacking, passing, clever type of football, and you just didn't get that from England. It was direct, and it was, you know, it was long balls, win second balls, you know, play the ball out wide, get crosses into the striker, that sort of thing. So not really suiting John Barnes' game. And I mean, if it's interesting because a lot of stylish players, never really did it for England. Never got the amount of caps they used to get or they should have got. And if they did, didn't really sort of have sort of great careers of England. When I look at England players that have done well, I can think of Gary Lineker, for example, who is just, you know, penalty box striker. Chris Waddle didn't really have a great England career. I mean, we mentioned Peter Beardsley, didn't really have a great England career. Not that what his talent you'd think warranted. Other players, Glenn Hoddle, did he have a great England career? Probably not.
Did okay.
You know. So I'd imagine if Barnes played for a Holland or, you know, a side like that, maybe he'd have been more successful. But in the England team, I think it was hard for a lot of players to shine.
It was just too rigid. I think that was the problem with it. And I'm really happy you brought up that Holland goal. At Wembley, because I watched that game and I really wanted England to go through because I genuinely think Graham Taylor was a good man. And, I remember it was like a double celebration. A, England had scored, but I wanted England to score. And the fact
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
That it was him, and the fact that he, that would have really annoyed some people, because they always wanted England to win, but not from him, because he was basically the one that they wanted out. And that was fine. It was a fantastic free kick as well. It really was. Mm. And he wasn't great in 1994. You know, he was heavier. He wasn't quite so mobile as he was. And that was just a lovely moment. That's my favorite John Barnes England moment ever.
Wow. I would have never guessed that.
No, yeah, just because it just rammed it down their throats. And
yeah, mine too. Rammed it down their throats. I mean, he's getting abused the whole game, Joe.
Well, it was weeks ago, wasn't it, Joe? Because all in the press for like 2 weeks, it was, he's going to play me now, just because he was a manager at Watford, and he's just, because Taylor was just getting abused constantly. So he's going to play him. He's going to play him just because he's his mate at Watford. And, you know, this man, supposed to be the manager, goes on and scores a goal like that. Absolutely fantastic. Love that man.
So, Barnes won, what was it? Was it 2 division titles at Liverpool? I believe so.
88 and 90, yeah.
And he won 2 FA Cups, they won the League Cup, they won the charity 3 times.
Yeah.
What was his, I know he had the Achilles injuries and I know he had to basically reinvent himself, but again, there's a period there and this man is just phenomenal. 1990 title winning side, scoring, I think, 20 goals, 22.
Well, people talk about 88, but in that 1990 season, and we're an aging side at that point, mm-hmm. he played a little bit further forward, and he was like goal, 1 in every 2 and a half games, something like that.
He's top scorer in the league, yeah. I think, in 89-90. I think he's 28 in all competitions.
Yeah.
He scores more goals. He scores more than Ian Rush that season, which is saying something, because yeah. Rush was a goal machine then. As Carl said, he played further forward. Some of the other players who peaked in 87-88 had just passed their best. So Barnes is even more head and shoulders above his teammates, in my opinion, that season. And it's funny, we bring Rosenthal in on loan for a few months at the end, and Rosenthal is fantastic in the last couple of months before the end of the season, and sort of gets us over the line in terms of the title. I'm not sure if he wins football writers at this time, but he gets PFA player of the year that season and top goal scorer. Mm-hmm. And that's just before the 1990 World Cup where Gazzamania then takes over the country. But as far as I'm concerned, in 1990, Barnes is the best player in the country again by a distance. And a lot of people don't mention the 1990-91 season where, I think that season is where he gets a really bad injury the second half of the season. But his start to that season is incredible. Absolutely mm-hmm. incredible. I think he gets like 12 goals, in the first few months.
We won the first 7 games, didn't we?
Yeah. Correct. Absolutely. It's when we beat United 4-0 at Anfield, the Beardsley hat trick.
Yeah.
And, Barnes is magnificent in that game. There's a game where we beat Leeds, I think 5-4 at Elland Road.
I was about that game.
If, If anyone listening, if you can watch extended highlights of that match, do so, because it's something else, that game. 5-4 at Illinois.
If you love the first half hour, then you'll get grey hair by the end of it.
By the end of it, yeah. And again, he's great in that game as well, but he gets a really bad injury. I can't remember exactly where it was. I think the second half of that season he gets the bad injury.
That is sort of
the beginning of the end of the flying wing of John Barnes.
Yeah. And then Arsenal really, really took off around that time as well. They won the league. And that's when he basically slowed down, and that's when the weight came on as well.
So if I ask both of you guys, and I hate comparisons, so I won't ask you, we kind of already brought up the Mane thing, but what kind of player was John Barnes, and would John Barnes fit into the modern game? I know sometimes people hate that question. Maybe that's an American thing, but I'm going to ask you guys that anyway.
100%. Because the balance he had, the close control he had, and the strength. If you're going to put him in a sort of modern setting now, Sadio Mane is the obvious example because of his pace, etc. But there's a little bit of Gini Wijnaldum in terms of physique in there as well. Very, very calm player on the ball, never got riled. And, could he play today? Yeah, he'd play for anyone today. He was just that good. Bearing in mind, we had some proper players around that time as well, and he was just streets ahead, absolutely streets ahead.
Yeah, agreed. Just the athleticism, he was really fit, strong, quick. You couldn't get the ball off him. Very rarely did he lose the ball in the dribble. He's one of those players that could fit in any area, really. I liken him. When Thierry Henry used to drift out to the left wing for Arsenal, he reminded me of John Barnes. I mean, Barnes wasn't as quick as that, but just the grace, the balance, the skill. Henry is an interesting example, and also David Ginola as well. So I think Barnes is like a cross between a David Ginola and a Thierry Henry for people who didn't get to see him in his prime, but saw Ginola and Thierry Henry in their prime. I do get the Mane and comparisons. There's definitely the ability to play wide but drift inside and get himself in goal scoring positions is I think really sort of close to what Mane brings. Not just a winger stuck out there putting crosses in, but very clever and working within a very fluent front three. The Beardsley, Aldridge and Barnes attack is my favourite ever Liverpool attack because they were so fluid. I mean, Orchard was a limited striker, but his movement was really good and he was a great finisher. And that front three, I loved the three of them that season. Them three and McMahon were my favourite players for a long time. Four of my favourite Liverpool players ever, really.
Love Steve McMahon. He was my favourite player. Absolutely love Steve McMahon, that season.
So would you guys put John Barnes into your top five all-time Liverpool players?
Absolutely. He's my number one, personally. There is bias there, but he's my... And I think probably maybe the age thing as well, because when you're watching football as a youngster, so how old was I in 1987, 88? 10 years old. So I think you look at players more starry-eyed then. By the time I was watching Steven Gerrard, I was a more of a cynical adult, so less started. I never saw Kenny in his prime. So for me, John Barnes is my number one, but I can understand people who would have Kenny above him or Gerrard above him. But I'm biased, but yeah, he's my number one.
It's really hard for me because my all-time favourite Liverpool player is a left-hand side of left midfielder and Ray Kennedy. So it's always difficult for me when it just comes up all the time. Like, you know, when you talk about who's your favourite ever Liverpool side, I'm not knocking Ray Kennedy out of any side ever. So it's difficult. Is he in the top five? He probably is in the top five. But it's definitely in my top 10 because, for me, my top two is always Dalglish and then Souness. And then Ray Kennedy probably after that, but, don't get me started on Ray Kennedy. I'll be here for months.
So I know you guys have seen him live. What's the best game you've ever seen him live?
The QPR game in 88, I think. QPR were top of the league because we hadn't played as many games as they did. We beat them 4-0 or 4-1. They had David Seaman in goal, bizarrely. And the second half performance we put in when Barnes got two goals, it was like a man just taking the piss out of football. He was just absolutely everywhere, and they were kicking him to pieces or whenever they could. And you know, they weren't a bad side at all. And he just smiled as he went past them. It was like Muhammad Ali when he knows he's going to knock someone out. He played like that. I'm just going to do this now. And it wasn't really arrogance. It was just sort of, let's all enjoy me doing this. He had Anfield in the palm of his hand. He was incredible in that game. If anyone hasn't seen it, just Google Liverpool QPR 1987, and it'll be on there.
Okay.
Or twice.
Was he?
It's funny, you know, because Carl mentions that game. He was there. I felt like I was there because I've watched the video footage of that so many times, and you just get drawn into the atmosphere. The crowd are chanting his name. The goals are just something else. You know, my first trip to Anfield was not until the late 90s, so I never got to saw him during his peak at Anfield. I saw the odd away game in London. So the game that sticks out to me is, I think there's a game in 1990, Wimbledon at Plough Lane, where Barnes scores a goal. I think we win 1-0. I can't remember exactly, but he plays. You know, he's the best player in the park again, and I think he scores. That down at Plough Lane. I've watched a few of his games live in the mid 90s. But by then he was, you know, he's the midfielder John Barnes, which is the less mobile, so not at his peak. But my favorite performances from him, are from the TV, really. That FA Cup run, and it's a shame we lost that, final to Wimbledon, because that FA Cup run in 87-88 is magical. The teams we beat, the Everton game, the one I mentioned before, where, you know, he's getting racially abused throughout the whole game, and he's magnificent. The semi-final against Nottingham Forest is great. And then you get the final as well, which I remember that final like it was yesterday, and it's just horrible. I remember that cup run more than I do the run into the title that season. Because it was such a shoo-in for the title, it was a formality. They didn't really show the games live in the run-in, which is weird when you think about the sort of coverage we get now. My memories of him really are through the television rather than being at the game. It's that 1987-88 season is something else, really. And even watching just the footage, you will get a sense of the atmosphere. I think I had an old VHS video. I think it was Liverpool Team of the Decade or something like
that. Yeah. Everyone has that.
I got it off of eBay.
Yeah.
And the rewind button gets absolutely rinsed. For those.
Is that the one where it's got the Hold of the Forest game on as well?
Yeah. It's extended highlights of that Forest game.
Yeah.
The Forest game is something else. I mean, Barnes is taking the piss to such an extent, you've got the commentator laughing. Yeah. It's ridiculous. I mean, our words can't do it justice. You need to watch. But I can imagine being actually in the crowd watching those games. There must have been something else. I'm jealous.
So I don't want to bring up spoil John Barnes's greatness by bringing up Newcastle or Charlton, because that was much.
No, you've got to, because there's one glorious moment in his Newcastle career. One fantastic moment when he was far too fat and slow to play in the position that they wanted to play him in. But Newcastle went to Goodison Park in the FA Cup and won 1-0. Ian Rush, who also played for Newcastle, also far too old to play for anyone, scored from a John Barnes cross. And it was, and they must have been about 35. And they were playing like 35-year-olds, and that was just glorious.
So,
there are a few things from the the non-flying John Barnes, sort of the latter end of his Liverpool career that are worth a mention, though. You've got the overhead kick at Ewood Park.
I still don't know that. Still don't know how he did that.
Great.
Yeah.
Great.
You've got the open goal he scores, and it sounds easy, the open goal he scores at the Dell, but I think the keeper kicks it to him and he does first times it back.
Oh, Dave Besson, yeah. He went 5 points player that day because of that.
Take notes, Alberto Moreno. That's how you put the ball in the empty.
Oh yeah, first time from the halfway line. Rolled it along the ground into the opposite post. And there was also his goal in the first round of the 91-92 FA Cup win against Crewe,
where he backflick.
Back injury and he just backflicked with his ankle. We were 3-0 at the time already, but it was just that he hadn't played much before that game, and he just comes in and it's like lads, I'm back. We don't even start heavier than, but you know, but
the magic was still in the feet, and also as well, what was great. Do you remember the fourth goal, in the 4-3 against Newcastle? The first 4-3, and you had Rush Barnes for about 5 minutes. And then Barnes passed to Collymore.
Pass the ball. Jesus.
Even now you're like, pass it to Collymore.
I'm still frustrated.
Eventually they get the ball out to him and he buries it. That was something else that game. So the magic was still there in the feet. Obviously the pace was gone, and he wasn't getting away from players anymore. And I remember the last season where we were in a good position. It was 96-97. They were top of the league for a long time that season, and then we just drifted away and ended up finishing fourth or something like that.
David James against Coventry.
Oh God. Yeah. And the overriding feeling was that we didn't have enough steel in the center, in the middle of the park. We had Redknapp, Michael Thomas and Barnes playing midfield roles, and all similar players at that time, you know, ball players, passes, not really good defensively, not really good in the tackle.
But he brought Redknapp was out, wasn't he? Thomas played.
Yeah.
Then Redknapp came back again, and Jamie Redknapp couldn't tackle to save his life, and Michael Thomas was pulled into it. And Evans replaced him. And then we just felt, you know, I think we were unbeaten for like 19 league games or something like that. He put Redknapp back in centre midfield with Barnes, and suddenly.
I like the Thomas Barnes partnership, you know, actually. Because
they worked really well together. One could pass, one could tackle.
Yeah. But then we decided to get rid of Barnes and bring in Paul Ince. And, that was the sad moment because, he didn't get his testimonial season, which would have been the following season. And he was off. It was really, I can't really remember any sort of long goodbyes, towards the Cop or anything like that. I think it was all sorted in the summer and it was sort of sorted.
Yeah, well, yeah. Ince made his debut at Sellers Park. I went to that. And, we all wanted Paul Ince to come in because we thought, you know, we can't attack him in midfield. You know, we need to do this. And Barnes was far too heavy at that point. You know, he really shouldn't be playing for about a year or so. The injuries had just got too much for him. But I remember when they came out, opening day of the season, and it was so hot at Sellers Park, and Ince led the side out as captain, and everyone near me went, didn't know he was going to be captain. We look, because of the United connection, that's quite a controversial thing. And we were all sort of like, we're glad that you're here, because, you know, there's rumours that United wanted him back. But not as captain. You're not taking a captaincy off John Barnes. You can take a position, but you're not taking a captaincy. And obviously Barnes had gone to Newcastle by then.
So do you guys think when Arsenal won the title that, do you think Barnes, cost them that? What was that, 87? 88?
Oh, 89.
When he lost possession and it came down and Michael Thomas, that was my sour note I was bringing about, talking about a few
minutes ago. Oh, okay.
Do you guys feel that was, I mean, that's basically the title decider.
There's no blame to him whatsoever. We played a ridiculous, because of Hillsborough, we played a ridiculous amount of games, and, my dad was an Everton fan, and he said to me, if Liverpool had to win that game 2-0, they would have won 2-0, but they didn't know how to defend 2-0. Because Arsenal had to win 2-0 to win the league. And we didn't know what to do when we went onto the pitch. Because we're not really the sort of side who just thinks we're just keeping 0-0 and win the league. And so my dad always said that if Liverpool would have had to have won that game 2-0, we would have won 4-0. Because that's what we were good at. No, there's no blame. To be honest, I hadn't even thought that it was him who lost the ball, to be honest. they were just exhausted. We just done the cup final. We played West Ham about 2 days earlier, something that week, two or three days before that. And yeah, we've just, and the emotion of Hillsborough and stuff like that. And some of those lads didn't want to play. So, Arsenal deserved the league as well. Arsenal were just a really, really good side. So,
there wasn't really a narrative around, John Barnes losing the ball, you know. So it wasn't really a thing. You know, these things sort of turn into a narrative when, you know, media get involved, begin to start a story on it. If you fans, as it is these days, you know, it's quick, a story develops relatively quickly. But back then, I can never really remember anyone actually saying, oh, bloody hell, Barnes lost the ball there. What the hell was he doing?
I didn't even know that happened, to be honest. Yeah, exactly.
So that really wasn't a thing. But I do remember the run into that season though, and we had a poor sort of first half of the season. We were miles behind Arsenal. We'd say, I don't know, around 12 games left, and we put in a really good run. So you had the FA Cup run, obviously led to, you know, the tragedy of Hillsborough. So we were really good in the FA Cup, and we were starting to win every week in the league, really building up some good momentum. And we were slaughtering teams. I think we beat West Ham. Was it 5-1 or something like 5-1. That?
Yeah.
And this was like 3 games before the Arsenal game. So I agree with what Carl's saying there. If we had to win that 2-0, I think we would have, to win the title. But it was such a change up. I mean, we were playing catch up for weeks and weeks and weeks, knowing we had to go into games and win to have any chance. And just that change in mentality where we knew that, you know, a one goal defeat and we would have won the title. I think that sort of, the mentality of that, I think caused that sort of freak result. And I call it a freak result because losing 2-0 at Anfield, back then was very rare. It's similar vibes in that game to the FA Cup final against Wimbledon where, You couldn't really put your finger on why the team just didn't perform. They played great leading up to the big game, and then the big game comes and, you know, don't really.
Well, they were good as well. I think that needs saying. Arsenal were really good.
Yeah, that is true. They were a really good side. Yeah. I mean, and the Arsenal title winning side in 1991 is an underrated team as well. No one really talks about that team, but I think they lose one game that season.
Yeah.
They were a really good side that season. And that George Graham, the George Graham Arsenal era, sort of it gets a bit swept under the rug these days, maybe because of the scandal that sort of finished his career at Arsenal. But yeah, it's worth saying that they were a really good side in that era.
Okay, so we talked about how great of a player he was, and I want to move into his managerial career. Now, most know that he was very unsuccessful at Celtic. He tried the Jamaica team, which he did have success there, and then Tranmere. I believe that was in 08 or 09, his last time. Do you guys feel that he deserves another shot? And if you do, do you think race plays a part in it? Whether he gets a job or doesn't get a job, because it's sort of the same way in America that we have what's called, most of you guys know what the NFL is, it's football. Yes, Rooney Rule, said perfectly. And they have to at least interview black candidates. So what do you guys feel? Does he get shafted here, or does he legitimately not deserve a second chance because he wasn't a good manager?
I think it's very hard to be Celtic manager and not be successful. I don't think that's a race issue as such. I think it just wasn't for him. I don't think he's got that sort of temperament. Be a manager. I've been to see him talk a few times, and I think sometimes he's just a bit too nice to be a manager. I would have said that when he was playing, to be honest. I don't think it's really him. I remember there's a book called by a man called Pete Davis called All Played Out about the 1990 World Cup, and there's a really interesting interview with Barnes. And he was absolutely prime Barnes at this time, and he said, the problem I've got is I'm lazy, but I'm good, but I'm lazy. And I don't think he. I mean, I could be completely wrong on this, because wasn't Jason McAteer involved as well? One of those clubs as well.
I just don't think he's got it in him. I don't think he's got that drive really to, you know, to, he's great at looking after himself, but I think some would look after it at people around him. I don't think it's his strength really.
Yeah, I could see her stood up on the Tranmere.
Yeah.
What about you, Coz?
I remember when Barnes was first trying to get into coaching, and he was complaining. Most of his complaints were about not getting interviews, sort of writing to applying for a lot of a position and not even getting replies. So from that respect, you know, you could say, you know, you could say maybe Race had sort of an impact there. Just the feeling among chairman. And it's a subconscious thing, really, that, nah, he's not really going to be a good manager. Just sort of based on the fact that, you know, you just don't, at that time, you just don't really get, good black managers. So maybe that's the perception. I don't know, but he did have a really good opportunity at Celtic though, because Dalglish was director of football.
Yeah.
And obviously they're really good friends and had that connection. So he gets his big chance there, but it doesn't work. Whether he didn't get long enough, I don't know, because he was sacked very quickly. I mean, he had the terrible defeat against, was it Inverness Caledonian Thistle?
Yeah.
Was it in the cup or in the, I think they get knocked out of the cup.
Yeah, and,
Yeah, I mean, he was in the hiding to nothing really, because from the beginning, I don't think the Celtic fans liked the appointment. And, you only needed a few bad results for it to really turn against him. And yeah, his position was untenable after a bad start.
Also, it's his first job. I mean,
Celtic is your first job. Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, how do you turn it down though? Because you might.
Yeah. Ever, yeah.
And he's never got an opportunity anywhere near as big as that since.
You're gonna finish second no matter what happens.
Yeah.
The lowest will finish is second.
He doesn't see out the season, and after that it's lower league clubs, isn't it? It's right into lots of clubs trying to get interviews, not getting an interview. And maybe if we had a Rooney rule, he might have got more chances to impress chairman, you know. But it didn't work out. I must say I've not been overly impressed with the way Barnes talks about the game. You know, some pundits you listen to talk about football and you think, it's really interesting there. Barnes, not really. I mean, Barnes talks a lot of sense about a lot of issues. When he talks about sort of from a tactical perspective, I've never really been one to sit up and take notice. Whether that sort of says anything, I don't know. That might not really say anything about what you like in the training ground with players. But at the moment, I think it's been so long that he's managed in the game that, you know, the likelihood of him getting a chance now is remote. I mean, you get people like Brian Robson, for example. Does Brian Robson manage at the moment? I've not heard of him for a long time. You do have a number of people who have been managers in a particular period of time, and then they just don't get associated with a coaching role for years. I'm trying to think of another example. Roy Evans. And Dalglish, for example, I mean, after Blackburn? No, after Newcastle, he has that, is it 10-year gap between then, between then and then, and then coming back to Liverpool and then leaving Liverpool. You didn't really think of Dalglish being a manager elsewhere.
No.
I would be surprised if Barnes, I think that ship has sailed now for him. Unfortunately.
He's doing his tour, isn't he? With Jim and the Five Time Club. He's happy doing that sort of thing now. He's more of an athlete in the circuit, man.
Yeah, he definitely seems that way. But listen, before I let you guys go, I put together a little fun quiz. We'll see who wins this. I know we've been having a real nice chat, but my first question is, and anybody can answer. I'm not going to go back and forth to one of y'all. So we all know that John Barnes scored his goal against Oxford United. Beautiful free kick. But what minute did he score that goal?
It was the second half. 52 minutes.
Okay, Carl says 52. Cozzy, what do you got?
Oh, man, I defer to Carl. I'd be completely guessing. Do you want me to just give you a number?
Just give me a number, man. Yep.
All right. 65.
Okay, Carl was closest, but it was actually the 37th.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. Second, how many total goals did he score for Liverpool?
It's over 100, isn't it? 102?
No. Not over 100.
84.
That is dead on.
Really?
84 is dead on.
Okay, that was a genuine guess.
That's a hell of a guess. The next one is, how many did he score in his total career? Club, obviously. We're not talking, you know, we're talking club. So that's Watford, Liverpool, Newcastle, Charlton.
170.
I'll go very. Is that close, is it? Yep. Okay. 168. I don't know.
It's actually 155. So.
Sorry, Joe.
And my last question is, some of these may be tough, but I think you guys have got this. So it's a two-part answer. So John Barnes lost 4 FA Cup finals in his career. Name the teams he lost to and the years that he lost.
Everton, yes. 83-84.
Yes.
Wimbledon, 87-88.
Yes.
United.
The Newcastle side in 99.
Yeah, he did play. Yeah, the Newcastle side is right. 98
against Arsenal.
Right. 98-99 against Arsenal. Or 97-98 against Arsenal. And then, yeah, the cream suits. The cream suits, unfortunately.
96, yeah.
Yeah. Against United.
Yeah, there it is, boys. Good work.
That final, that's another letdown where we play great leading up to a final and the big game comes and we, for whatever reason, we don't put in a performance.
Well, nor did they, which is even more frustrating.
Yeah, it was a really weird game that.
Yeah, it was terrible. They were both terrible.
All right, gentlemen. So I know we've been recording for a while and I really appreciate anyone going to learn a hell of a lot more if they listen to this, especially younger people who only know the name but have never seen a damn thing or know really much about John Barnes. But before I let you go, do you have any plugs? Carl, I'll start with you.
Yeah, probably several. I've got two books. One is a novel called And What Do You Do? Which is £2 on Amazon. And I wrote a book with Sash Dakrani called We're Everywhere Us about in 2015. And just basic various writing on the outfield and next on the outfield rap.
Beautiful. Cozy, what about you, man? I know you just did a podcast, but you probably got other stuff coming up.
Yeah, I got the, we're going to do a film review, not a review, but this, we're going to have a chat about Coming to America. That great comedy, Eddie Murphy. And that's going to be with Joe Simpson and Harinder.
Really?
Probably next week. Yeah, that one's been delayed a couple of times. Through no one's fault, really. Just for the circumstances. We're gonna have that. Probably next week we'll record it, I think. But yeah, I'm looking forward to that because, one of my all time favorite films.
It was on a few days ago. I think I know every single word of that film.
Yeah, I probably know it off by heart. Watched that a million times.
That is a great film. I am going to record another Legends podcast in a few days. We are doing, well, you know what? I'll leave it up for surprise, but it'll be another big, big footballer. But again, appreciate you guys coming on, staying up late. Big shout out to Guy Drinkle. I'm staring at your picture on my Skype. You're smiling. I still hope you're smiling right now, pal. I really appreciate you not only recording, but editing, because I know that is not an easy job. So from me, my guest, and Mr. Drinkle, you guys have a good night. Up the Reds.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.